Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. If you're just joining us, we're at the conference. We're at the Catholic Answers annual apologetics conference and having a great time. It's Ask Me Anything this hour. Jimmy Akin is our guest. You all know Jimmy Akin, senior apologist at Catholic Answers. And any of you have any idea what kind of world Jimmy Akin... That is correct. A mysterious world. Jimmy Akin's mysterious world. You can find it at mysterious.fm. Tomorrow's Friday. What's dropping tomorrow, Jimmy?
Tomorrow we're looking at the mystery of the Toynbee tiles, is a set of tiles. A guy discovered them in the 1990s. They appear in hundreds of cities around the U.S. and even in a few foreign countries. And they say strange things like Toynbee idea, resurrect dead on planet Jupiter, and other things that are very interesting. So this gentleman and a group of associates went in search of trying to crack the mystery, who's behind them, what do they mean, and all that stuff, and we'll be letting you know the answers.
Check it out. Each Friday morning you can get a new episode. What is it, about 350 now? Episodes?
Are we in the 350? No, this is like 331.
331, so getting close.
Of the numbered episodes.
Of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, mysterious.fm, or check it out on YouTube. All the questions are coming from in the room today, and we have a lineup. I made Tess wait last time. Tess is an old and good friend, and I'm very glad you're going first this hour, Tess. Go ahead with your... Tess is from San Diego. Go ahead, Tess, with your question.
Can I hold it? Oh, sorry. Okay. Some priests, to my observation and my experience, some priests are very sensitive to the noise that's going on while the Mass is going, like... Children being cranky, cell phone going on. And some priests, they really focus on the Mass and they don't care whether the kids are crying or cell phone going on. But then what happens when the celebrant had an emergency like collapse? What happens to the Mass, and do I have an obligation, being a Catholic? What is my obligation besides calling 911? On top of calling 911, what is my obligation being a Catholic to be actively participating what must go on, because it's a middle of the Mass, especially when the priest is raising the Holy Eucharist and then he collapses. So what happens?
All right, Jimmy.
Okay, well, let's deal with the part of the question that I'm sure of, and then I'll get some clarification if needed. So... Before the current order of Mass was released in 1979, there was a document that was standardly released. It was called Defectibus, was the short form, which means on defects. And the full title was like, on defects occurring in the celebration of the Mass. And it dealt with a whole bunch of scenarios, just like the one you mentioned. And it indicated what should happen. Now, for some reason, they didn't issue a new version of De Defectibus when they released the new Rite of Mass, but I think the principles in it are still sound. And so I would apply the same principles you find in De Defectibus. Basically, if a priest collapses and is unable to finish Mass, what happens is meant to be affected by what part of the Mass he collapses during. If he collapses before the consecration, then the Mass can simply be terminated. And in that case, if it was a Sunday Mass, you wouldn't need to go to another Mass you'd be welcome to, but you showed up for a Mass. And so you wouldn't have an ongoing Sunday obligation because you did your part. On the other hand, suppose he collapses after the consecration of both elements. In that case, it is possible for you know, his medical needs obviously to be taken care of, assuming he's still alive. But it's possible for the mask to also be suspended at that point if there's no one to distribute, or if it's not practical to distribute the consecrated elements to the staff. They can be reposed, although someone's going to need to consume the precious blood. For practical purposes, what's likely to happen is there will be a temporary suspension of the mass while the priest's medical needs are dealt with, and he may be taken to the hospital or something like that, and then assistants like the deacons or the extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion can distribute the elements afterwards, although that's not strictly necessary. The trickiest part is what happens if he collapses after the consecration of the bread and before the consecration of the wine. That's where it gets really tricky, because according to church law, the bread is never to be consecrated without the wine also being consecrated. And the Code of Canon Law uses the term nephos to refer to that, which is Latin for under no circumstances is this ever allowed to happen. And so in that case, what is supposed to happen is, you know, the priest's medical needs get dealt with, but the mass is temporarily put in a state of suspension until such time as another validly ordained priest can be brought in to consecrate the wine and complete the liturgy. And even though not everybody needs to stay there, if that happens, somebody needs to stay until the new priest can arrive to protect the consecrated elements, those that have been consecrated. So that's a general sketch of what needs to happen if a priest collapses during Mass. In terms of what you need to do, well, call 911, pray, and do what you can. If there's no one else to do CPR, you could do CPR. Or if there are other people there who are better able to do CPR, you can leave it to them. But there aren't any specific obligations beyond just what common sense and common sense morality would tell you.
Did that get to what you wanted?
Yeah, it's a very good answer. But in relation to that, so in general, it should be, the mass should be finished.
Assuming that it's all possible, yes.
Let's say the priest in the rectory, you know, just close by, and then
right.
You call that priest. Okay,
he
come
comes
on, Father.
Over and finishes it.
Father A, collapse. Father B, can you finish the mass? Mm-hmm. And then that would be the completion of the mass. And if there's nobody available, then temporarily suspended. Is that the part that you're talking about?
If the priest collapses after the consecration of the host and before the consecration of the chalice, then the mass has to be temporarily suspended until such time as you can get in another priest, including a priest from another parish. If there's not one here in town, it may take hours for someone to get in.
Thank you, Tess. Thanks very much for coming again. It's nice to see you here. Catholic Answers Live, coming to you live from the Catholic Answers Conference. I think we've got time for another question. Marilyn from Colorado Springs, Colorado is here. Welcome
Hi.
Back, Marilyn.
Thank you. This is a little bit personal. For Mr. Aiken, as a convert, how did you incorporate the deuterocanonical books into your biblical worldview?
I just read them. I mean, I thought I'd read the whole Bible, and then it turned out, oh, there's these extra 7 bonus books. Well, it's time to read them, too. So I just read them. Well, not to my fundamental Christian worldview, no. The deuterocanonicals are divine revelation, but they are not the most important parts of divine revelation. Just like even among the protocanonical books, they're not all of equal doctrinal value. Like if you look at the books of the Old Testament, Jesus regularly quotes Genesis, Isaiah, and the Psalms. So those were the high value works in Jesus's mind. But other works within the protocanonical books of the Old Testament, like, you know, 2 Samuel, or 2 Chronicles, they're not as important. And so the Deuterocanonicals tend to be of this lower order. They do contain divine revelation, but it's not the most crucial revelation. Where they made more of a difference was not for my worldview, but for apologetics, because there are certain teachings that are better documented in the Deuterocanonicals, particularly in 2 Maccabees, than elsewhere. For example, prayer for the dead is documented in 2 Maccabees. Similarly, offer and sacrifice for the dead is documented in 2 Maccabees. And so that would give me additional material to be explored in doing apologetics, but it didn't fundamentally affect my worldview.
Thank you, Marilyn. Thanks very much. That brings us right to the break. We'll take a break. Be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
EWTN offers listeners and viewers the daily readings to enable you to accompany the Mass of the day. Our Catholic daily readings include the readings of the day, along with online videos. It's a great resource for all who desire to live a life of faith that is pleasing to our Lord. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. It's time for our Catholic Answers Annual Apologetics Conference. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, will be one of the speakers. Each of our apologists will be one of the speakers here, but also we'll have Father Sebastian Walsh, Dr. Billy Junker, Dr. Greg Gerendi is going to be here, and Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn will be here. We're really looking forward to a wonderful weekend of talking about the parables, sayings, conversations of Jesus Christ. We're starting it all off with this live broadcast of Catholic Answers Live. And up next is Deacon Julian of Colusa, California. Deacon, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having us. My question is a technical question, and it is, why did the Vatican change or eliminate both in the liturgy, both in the Mass and Liturgy of the Hours, for example, closing prayers or collects, where it used to say things like, one God forever and ever, amen, take out the one? I've asked several priests, even bishops, haven't gotten an answer.
So I want to make sure, I had a little trouble hearing you. Why did the Vatican remove the word one in the phrase, one God forever and ever, in the liturgies?
Correct.
Well, I'd have to check and see what the underlying original was, because one of the things that happened after the Second Vatican Council was in 1973, the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments put out a document in French called Comme le Prévoit. And one of the things that Comme le Prévoit did was it mandated a dynamic equivalence form of translation. So the idea was, we're going to express the same word, not the same words in a new language, but the same general thought that's in the original language in the receptor language, which would be English in our case. And that gave the translators a great deal of flexibility in how they translated particular passages. And there was also an emphasis on trying to be hip and contemporary and use street English rather than dignified, elevated English. And this had some unfortunate effects. For one thing, because they were imitating street English, it brought down the tone of the Mass and other liturgies like Liturgy of the Hours substantially. And because street English changes all the time, You know, every 20 years, I mean, Cy, you remember groovy used to be a word, but you seldom hear it now.
You do in the groovy music, however,
you do
on
in
every
the,
Friday.
In the groovy music. Yeah. But this led to a desire on the part of the International Commission for English and Liturgy to want to constantly just be translating and retranslating texts. It also became politicized, and so around the year 2000, not exactly, but around that time frame, the Holy See mandated enough. We're going back to a formal equivalence style of translation, and it's going to be elevated. We're going to follow. We're not going to imitate street English. We're going to do more elevated English. And we're going to not have constant new translations. We're going to let the translations be passed down from one generation to another. And when they did that, they also had to replace all of the existing translators, basically. But when they did that, it resulted in a lot of shifts in how particular phrases got rendered. Now, they tried to leave the most common prayers, particularly those said by the laity, they tried to leave those mostly alone because people were used to them. But whenever there is a shift between what you were hearing in a liturgical text that was issued between 1969 and about the year 2010 and what you hear now, it's frequently because of that shift in translation. Having said that, I'd have to look in the original Latin to see what was exactly there. But my guess, without having the ability to do research on the spot, is it may be due to a shift in translation philosophy.
Thank you, Deacon. Thanks very much. Glad you're here. Ask me anything, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Up next, Fred from Washington, West Virginia. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. I've always been curious when the Bible talks about stories where Jesus and the disciples traveled from here to there, how'd they sustain themselves? What did they eat? Did they stay in inns overnight? They talk about the women took care of them from their resources. But I don't know how you would travel the distances they did and still be able to live, I guess.
Okay. Well, basically, they would send out foraging parties. And so, you know, Jesus would direct some of the disciples to go out and raid local farms to get the supplies they needed and then bring them back to their headquarters, and then they'd feast them. Now, if the disciples were behaving ethically, they would also try to compensate the locals for the supplies they were taking from them. But in some cases, maybe with Judas, they didn't always get the compensation. Oh, wait, no. I'm sorry, that's the American Civil War. There were some travel lodges that you could find in the ancient world. We see an example of that in Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan, where after the Jewish guy gets mugged and left for dead, the Samaritan finds him, takes him to a travel lodge, and, you know, pays his bills. So there were some of those, but they weren't everywhere, and you couldn't count on them being available. Now, you could count on hospitality, because one of the things about the ancient Near East was it was a precarious environment. And so in precarious environments where people need to travel for, you know, all kinds of different purposes, but where there's not a Motel 6, you know, every few miles, anybody can end up in a situation where they need support in order to get through the night. And so that resulted in the development of a hospitality ethic. So it was considered unethical if you had a stranger in town and you didn't help them out. And so there was a kind of informal safety net that Jesus and the disciples could count on for that purpose. They also carried money with them. We know we have the mention in Luke's gospel about the women who supported the ministry. We also know that Judas was the keeper of the money bag. John tells us that. So they did bring money with them in order to be able to purchase supplies. And they could, you know, count on some degree of hospitality if they were in a town that didn't have a travel lodge available. They might stay in a travel lodge if there was one, or they would stay in private homes. That's something we see Jesus talking about when he sends out both the 12 and later the 72. He says, when you enter a town, if there is a man of peace there, enter that house and don't go from house to house, but stay there until you're done. And so they would often be received into private homes as part of the hospitality ethic that existed in ancient Israel. You mentioned how they could travel the distances they did. One thing to be aware of is these distances were not big. Israel is a tiny, tiny state by American standards. It is like, you know, 100 miles long, and at the most, it's at the thinnest, it's like 15 miles wide. It gets wider than that, but these are very small distances. One of the things I was struck by when I first went to Israel was how close everything is together. It is not at all far by American standards. It's not like driving from Arkansas to California.
Not at all. Fred, thank you. I'm really glad that we didn't have to go to the break while Jesus was sending out raiding parties there. That would have been awful to take
foraging
a break.
Foraging parties.
And people will be like, what? Thank you, Fred. Thanks very much. Holly from Roger, Arizona. Is that you, Holly?
Arkansas.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I read that. I apologize.
Listen, that's common.
Two Arkansans.
It's common. Arkansas is AR. Arizona is AZ.
Correct.
Well, I am glad you're here, but you're speaking to another Arkansan here.
I know. Real close, actually, and I didn't know it. So that first, thank you all at Catholic Answers. I converted 25 years ago from Baptist Seminary, grew up Methodist, and with y'all's help. And maybe him, I don't know, but I was very grateful for
it.
And I have remained so. I am the only Catholic in my evangelical family. I'm friends in the Bible Belt. I am the only one. I got 45 first cousins. I am the only one in our dance class, in our, you know, friends. Everywhere I go, I am confronted and around Protestants. I have resorted lately to going, how do we be one? And I'm saying, people go to both churches because everybody thinks it's a denomination and they can't become Catholic and there's all kinds of problems with it. So I say, okay, go to the Catholic Church, take the body and blood of Jesus, and go with your friends and do that Bible study thing that you do because it's just music. It's just a Bible study. It's just good preaching, whatever. But go to the Catholic Church. So I go on Saturday night sometimes, and then Sunday morning I can go anywhere I want, trying to make, you know, say, hey, I went to your church. How are you? You know, just trying to reach out. I'm asking, okay, is that wrong? Because I have been told by one priest only, do not ever go to another church. And I'm asking because I'm trying to reach people.
Okay, I need to ask a clarifying question because you said you were exhorting people to go to the Catholic Church and receive the body and blood of Christ. Are the people you're exhorting to do that Catholics?
No.
Okay.
They're Protestants, everybody I know.
Okay, so you don't want to encourage, under ordinary circumstances, you don't want to encourage Protestant Christians to receive the Eucharist in the Catholic Church. There are limited circumstances in which they're allowed to receive the Eucharist, but they're ordinarily for Protestant Christians as opposed to Eastern Orthodox Christians. But for Protestant Christians, there ordinarily needs to be some extreme circumstances like danger of death being one of them. They also need to share the church's faith. So I would encourage them to come to the Catholic Church and participate in the worship. But if they're not Catholic, they ordinarily should not be receiving communion. In terms of what you're doing, of going to a Catholic Mass to fulfill your Sunday obligation and then going elsewhere as an evangelistic effort, you're fully welcome to do that. The church acknowledges the legitimacy of going to other Christian churches and learning about their worship and participating to the degree that it is reasonable with them, you might want to look at there's a document called the Principles and Guidelines on Ecumenism that talks about common prayer and education about learning each other's worship services and things like that. It's put out by the Dicastery for the Promotion of Christian Unity. And there used to be one called Principles and Norms of Ecumenism, but the newer one, but you want to look at the newest version of that.
My clarification would be that some of them are maybe fallen away Catholics, mm-hmm. and they're going to Protestant churches, and then it's like, I agree, I don't want them to come and take Catholic Mass, but they think we're crazy. It's like, so in order to get over that denominational problem, I'm saying, well, come, just come. Yeah. And yes, I agree, don't take the Eucharist.
We're going to the break, but I just want to say, if they're former Catholics, then of course they're welcome to receive the Eucharist. They may need to go to confession first, though.
Holly, thank you so much. Got to take a break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Little bit of groovy music for you. Yeah, Jimmy is doing more Friday shows, so we're having the groovy music on Fridays now, but there's a little bit of Thursday groovy music for you. It seems to follow Jimmy around. I believe the groovy music follows Jimmy around. It's Ask Me Anything.
By request.
by Jimmy's request,
When they told me that they were, could I move to Friday, I say, well, sure, but the groovy music needs to come with.
So the groovy music travels. Wherever Jimmy goes, you will find that groovy music. It's probably all over Arkansas now that he's moved there. They probably got groovy music everywhere. You're welcome to ask your question as long as you're here in this room. We are at the Catholic Answers Annual Conference, and lots of folks are lined up with questions for Jimmy. So back to the questions we go. Andrea from Boise, Idaho.
Right.
Very nice to see you, Andrea.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Cy.
Hi.
Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy.
I love your show. I enjoy EWTN very much. I'm asking a question about John 6, mm-hmm. the Bread of Life Discourse. Mm-hmm. Our Catholic understanding of Christ's words to us is that indeed, quote, he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me and I in him, end quote. We believe the Eucharist is really the body and blood, soul and divinity of Christ. My Protestant friends use verse 63 against us, and I quote, It is a spirit that gives life. The flesh is of no avail, end quote. Would you please explain in a way that's where I can convince my friends or help them understand our position on this, because it seems to be a recurring theme. They won't listen to reason when I try to explain what Christ was doing in that discourse.
Okay, so one of the things that I find helpful is to kind of do a survey in talking to folks, of, by which I mean give an overview of the shape of Christian thought on a passage like this, because very often people are only familiar with what their buddies in their own little group think, and they're not aware of the full diversity of Christian opinion. I would point out as one kind of step in the process of helping them understand that, you know, the vast majority of Christians recognize that Jesus is talking about the Eucharist here. This is the view in the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Oriental Orthodox Church, which is not the same as the Eastern Orthodox Church, and the Assyrian Church of the East, and in Anglicanism and in Lutheranism, and depending on which groups of Methodists you're talking to, them, and so, and even others beyond that. And so the great majority of Christians recognize that John 6 is talking about the Eucharist. And there's a good reason for that, because Jesus is known from the three synoptic gospels to take bread and say, "This is my body," and eat it, all of you, and the same thing with taking wine. And so he's known for instituting a Christian ritual that is based on this, that's in all three of the synoptic gospels. And so John, we know, is writing with what I refer to as supplemental intent. That means he's writing to supplement what is known from the three synoptic gospels. And this is very easy to demonstrate. Like at one point, you'll be reading along, this is a little bit earlier in John, you'll be reading along and he mentions John the Baptist and he says, "This was before John the Baptist was put in jail." And it's like, what? If John was all you knew, what do you mean John the Baptist was put in jail? That's never mentioned anywhere else in the Gospel of John. What it shows us is he's writing to supplement what's in the other three. He at least knew Mark, and we've got good evidence he knew Luke. Matthew's a little dicier, but there also seems to be a reflection of this at the end of John's gospel, where he says Jesus did many other things, and if all of them were written down, I don't even suppose that the world would contain the books that would need to be written. So it's that feels like he's given a little bit of pushback about, you know, well, John, you know, tell us what you know about Jesus. I mean, write more. And it's like, I've got to give up at some point. So we know that John is writing with supplemental intent, and Jesus is famous for creating a ritual that involves symbolically or realistically eating his flesh and drinking his blood. That's exactly what we've got here in John 6. And so it is natural for Christians who don't have some other agenda to look at this and say, okay, he's talking about the Eucharist here. That leaves us with the issue of how do we deal with the particular verse you mentioned about the spirit gives life, the flesh profits nothing. Well, there are a couple of ways of dealing with that. One of them is by going through John 6 and noting that, and I won't do this at the moment because I've written about it and so forth and it's on Catholic.com, but basically do the normal exegetical stuff to show that he is talking about the real presence here. But specifically on that verse, the first thing I would say is if the flesh profits nothing, then Jesus died for nothing because he sacrificed his flesh on the cross for us. And he's talking here, you know, about eat my flesh, drink my blood. If he's saying my flesh profits nothing, then he died for no reason. And that's clearly not what he's saying. So he must be using the word flesh in a different sense. So let's look around the Gospel of John and see, do we find the word flesh being used in a different sense? Yes, we do. If you look a couple of chapters later, Jesus is talking to his critics and saying, you judge according to the flesh. So that means from a human perspective that can't accept the divine and the miraculous. But this, bringing it back to John 6, the Spirit gives life. So the flesh, the human perspective that's closed off to divine miracles, at least ones right in your own presence, that's not going to profit you. But if you're open to the Spirit, then you can accept Jesus' words for meaning what they say. So that's a basic look at how I would deal with it in outline form.
Andrea, thank you very much. Kim is next, also from Boise, Idaho. Kim, boy, you got the sun right in your eyes, don't you? Well, good luck with this, Kim. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. Recently, the Holy Father said that all religions are pathways to reach God.
Nope.
How should Catholics understand this?
Well, he didn't actually say that. He said all religions are paths to God. He did not say to reach God. And the version that you just quoted is actually better than some, including the translator. Now, he said this in Singapore, and he speaks Italian and Spanish. He doesn't speak the local languages. What they had was a translator next to him who was translating it into English, English being one of the languages in Singapore. And I was watching the video footage of this, and I'm listening to the English translator botch the translation. Instead of saying what I could literally hear the Pope saying in Italian, that all religions are paths to God, he's like saying ways of arriving at God, and that is not the same thing. So a path is a way by which you approach something, but it doesn't guarantee that you're going to arrive at the destination or that you're going to arrive at a perfect understanding of God if you're approaching from a different path. What we know, and I've actually commented on this in a couple of different places, if you go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/JimmyAiken, I've got a whole big interview on this where I walk through it sentence by sentence. But basically, you need to frame it in terms of what we know about Pope Francis. We know he's very big on evangelization. So you shouldn't read this as a denial of the need for evangelization or a denial of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Also, you got to read it in context. When you read the sentence that sets up this discussion, he says to the young people who are an interreligious group, he says, I want to compliment y'all on your courage in pursuing interreligious dialogue. So that's the subject. The subject is not an abstract statement about religions in general. It's how to conduct interreligious dialogue. He then says, now what happens if you get into a big fight as you're having interreligious dialogue? And, he elicits an answer, and the young people, one of them says, destruction. You know, that's where fights lead. And he's like, right. So when you're doing interreligious dialogue, you don't want to be getting into fights about my God is better than your God and stuff like that. All religions are paths to God. That's true. They all are ways that people seek the divine. He then goes on to note that there is ultimately only one God. And so all these different religions are striving after that one God. They aren't all going to have the right view of God. They're going to have a mixture of other ideas. But that's fundamentally what he's talking about. He's not saying all religions are equal or that they all have a correct understanding of God. He's saying that as part of interreligious dialogue, you need to not fight. You need to recognize that all religions are paths by which people seek God, and ultimately there is only one God that we're all seeking.
Kim, got to leave it there because it's break time. Thank you very much for coming from Boise and for the question. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Aiken on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, "When we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue." Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
This is Conversations with Consequences, where we delve deeper into issues affecting our church, our country, and our core, the family.
As Catholics, we need to be informed, aware, and able to talk through some of the tough topics that we're facing in our culture and in our world. Conversations with Consequences gives us the tools to do so.
It's not enough to pray. We have to be a light for the world.
Conversations with Consequences, Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live. We're coming to you live from the Catholic Answers annual conference. Lots of talks to come, but this begins the whole thing. We get together for the radio show, and people are gracious enough. Thank you all for coming out and making us feel important by staying here for the radio show. We're awful glad you did. We've got some more questions for Jimmy Akin. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin this hour, and Justin is from Lafayette, Louisiana. Hi, Justin.
Hey, thanks for taking my question. So my question is about the phrasing of the account of the wedding at Cana in the Gospel of John. So according to the translation I have, it says, "On the third day there was a wedding feast at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Mm-hmm. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples." So I'd never thought about that too much before, but it did strike me as interesting that it mentions the mother of Jesus first, and if I had no other context, it almost sounds like an afterthought. That Jesus and his disciples were there. Now, I know that every word in the Gospels has significance, so I was wondering, one, is that the sense of the original text? And two, if it is, what is the theological or linguistic significance of phrasing it that way?
Okay, so it is what's in Greek. It does mention Mary first. And in terms of why that is, it's not something that grammar tells us, but it's something that literary criticism may be able to shed light on. A safe interpretation that I think has been around for forever is that Mary's mentioned first to set up the fact that she's a key player in this story. However, there's another, and I think better, interpretation that has surfaced in recent years. There is a literary device that the Gospels employ known as an inclusio. An inclusio is where you have material that is bracketed before and after by a reference to something. And one form of inclusio that's been proposed, and this is particularly by a British scholar named Richard Baucom, is called the inclusio of eyewitness testimony. So that by mentioning someone at the beginning of a story and at the end of the story, you identify the tradent, the source of that tradition. And so I need to check the end of this story to see, is there a parallel reference to Mary close to the end? There may or may not be, but I would suggest that the reason that Mary is mentioned first, whether it formally qualifies as an inclusio of eyewitness testimony is or not, is John is indicating to us, this is how I got this information. Because we know the beloved disciple took Mary into his own house, into his own home, at the end of the gospel and cared for her for an extended period of time. And so it's logical to me that when we have a story in which Mary's a key player, he got that from her. And by mentioning her first, I think he's trying to signal the audience, this is where I got this information. Whether or not it fits the exact form of an inclusio or not, that would be my guess for why he mentions Mary first in this text.
Justin, thank you very much. Nice close reading of the scripture. Very nice. All right, up next, Beverly from Detroit, Michigan. Welcome, Beverly.
Hello, Jimmy. I don't know that there's a good answer, but I'm hoping for a better answer to a question asked by a child going through confirmation class, being taught the importance of going to Mass on Sunday. May have even remembered that it's a mortal sin not to go. And hey, Mom and Dad don't go. What does that mean for my parents? How does one answer that?
Well, you could say your parents are going to hell. I'm not recommending you say that. Just thinking through the sample space of possible options. What I would tend to say is, well, going to Mass is very important. And there are times in some people's lives where they don't realize how important it is. But it is important. And what this does is it creates an occasion for you to help your parents. You know, normally, children are dependent on their parents. Their parents help them a lot. But they don't so often have the opportunity to help their parents, especially with big important things. So this is an opportunity for you to encourage your parents to come to Mass and to bring you to Mass. Now, they may or may not do that, and it's not your fault if they don't, but this is important to do, and because it's important to do, you can help your parents do something really important by encouraging them to come to Mass, and of course, praying for them, and you know, being kind to them and so forth. But that's how I would tend to approach it.
Thank you, Beverly. And did you say you're a catechist?
My husband, I asked on his behalf.
Well, God bless him. We really appreciate that. Thank you, husband, for the work as a catechist. Veronica is from Portland, Oregon. Veronica, welcome back. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. My question is actually a question for my friend. She asked me to ask this. She's been reading about the visions that many mystics or saints have, and she's wondering how much do we believe the images that they see, how much are they real, and how much are they coming from God, and how much are actually the psyche or the image, you know, the brain of the someone who's seeing them is involved in those images so that they understand something supernatural.
Okay, so the answer is going to depend on which mystic or visionary you're talking about. There is a whole spectrum of different levels of quality in reported mystical visions. Some of them are demonic deceptions. Some of them are conscious frauds. Some of them are unconscious frauds, just someone's imagination. Then we get to the ones that where God is, some of them are genuinely supernatural where God's acting in them, but there's this whole spectrum. So what I'm gonna do, I'm not gonna worry about the ones that are not coming from God. I'm gonna talk about the ones that are genuinely supernatural. Even in those, there is an admixture of the seer's consciousness. An example that I often point out comes from Pope Benedict XIV. When he was still Cardinal Prospero Lambertini, he worked at what would later be the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, and he wrote the definitive work on evaluating various factors related to saint canonization. It's still in print, it's still used today, even though it's more than 200 years old. One of the things that he pointed out was that there was a controversy in his day between visionaries who had visions of Christ being crucified with three nails, that's one through each palm and one through both of the feet, and other visionaries were seeing Christ crucified with four nails, one through each palm and one through each foot. And there was a controversy about which is it? You know, which vision should we believe on this? And he made the point, God is not given the vision to teach us the number of nails. God is given the vision to help the visionary appreciate what God did for us, but that specific number of nails is being filled in by the consciousness of the seer. And so even in a genuinely supernatural experience, it's received by the consciousness of an individual person, and that shapes how they understand it. So we shouldn't look at the visions as if they are unadulterated representations of the will of heaven. We need to treat them more gently than that. And this is something that the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith has really stressed in its recent evaluation of various visions. One of the things they've been doing, even when they issue an approval, which is actually not saying that it's of supernatural origin, just that it's healthy, is they frequently will include clarifications. Like if you look at the recent document they issued on Medjugorje, they said, okay, people could have a healthy devotion to this, but there are certain clarifications, because there were some things that were, they said, were admixtures of the seer's consciousnesses that the faithful need to be aware of and not take too seriously. So if you want a good example of how to pull apart, you know, what's likely to be of human origin versus what may be of divine origin, I would suggest reading the Queen of Peace Medjugorje document that you can find on the website of the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith.
Thank you, Veronica. Thanks very much. Dan from Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome back, Dan. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay. I wanted to, first of all, comment that John definitely is supplemental. Now, in the there's a history of the church that was written around the year 400, I think it's by Eusebius, that documents, in some sense, how John came to write the gospel. And
I feel bad about this, Dan, but I didn't tell you. We're very close to the end. So
all right. I would want like you, sir, to comment on that very thing. The fact that it is really, truly instrumental, not supplemental, excuse me.
Well, I'm convinced that John has supplemental intent in when he writes. There is a very good essay on this by the British scholar Richard Baucom called John for Readers of Mark. It's in a book called The Gospels for All Christians, if I recall correctly. And what he does is he shows how the outline of John's gospel intersects with the Gospel of Mark's outline. So the two of them are meant to go together. I expanded that work on my own website, jimmyakin.com. I point out some additional interlocking that Baucom did not discover. And so I think it's very clear that John is consciously writing to supplement at least Mark and Luke. I'm less convinced of Matthew, although there is a book out there called John's Use of Matthew, where someone argues that he used Matthew. I just think the case is weaker for Matthew. Supplemental intent is something that John definitely has, and we need to take that into consideration when we read John in connection with the Synoptic Gospels. It's not that he doesn't know about stuff that's in the Synoptics. He's deliberately leaving it out because books were fantastically expensive in his day. A single copy of the Gospel of Matthew would cost more than $2,200, the equivalent. So there was enormous price pressure to keep your books less than the length of a standard scroll, and therefore John has to leave out material that's in the Synoptic Gospels if he wants to supplement it with new material that's not recorded in them.
And Dan, thank you very much. We won't be able to follow up because the music is about to start. We are right on the verge of the music playing. Jimmy Akin, pretty good, huh? You like the work Jimmy Akin does? He'll be here all weekend. Don't forget to tip your waitress. Hey,
the veal is really good.
Check him out on mysterious.fm. Also, there's his new work, the podcast and YouTube work. You can check it out on YouTube. Just check out Jimmy Akin on YouTube. You can find him there. Check out all that he is making available there with his two podcasts now. two podcasts from Jimmy Akin. That will do it for us. I'm sorry we didn't get to Luz, but she came all the way from Singapore. Can you believe that? And then we didn't get her on the air. Sorry about that. All right, that will do it for us. We'll see you next time. God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.